art is created for oneself as the audience. There may be other audience members who view it after the fact, but ultimately the art is created to express something, to be important and valuable to the creator, to the artist. And I think it also doesn't have to have a purpose or solve a problem. It's meant to demonstrate emotion. It's meant to share whatever gooey stuff is on the inside in a gooey way on the outside.
Hello, print friends, and welcome. This is a bilingual podcast, so if you subscribe to us, you'll be getting episodes in English with me, as well as in Spanish, with Reynaldo Gil Zambrano. Together, we talk to people around the globe about their practice and passions in the field of print media and multiples. This episode is brought to you by Speedball Art Products, and we are delighted to kick off 2024 by letting you know about their new product. The Speedball Spinbat. Designed by the talented Alex Carmona, this tool allows you to hold your woodblock securely in place for carving while easily rotating the block as needed. Save your non-dominant hand, wrist, elbow, and shoulder for many more years of happy carving. With the Speedball Spinbat, you don't need to waste any energy holding down your block. It can all go towards the joy of carving. Find out more at speedballart.com. This episode is also brought to you by Legion Paper. Legion Paper is a fine art paper company that represents the best papers in the world. They either stock it, source it, or make it. With brands like Stonehenge, Somerset, Coventry, Reeds, Arches, and more, Legion is the best paper resource for every artist and printmaker's needs. Learn more about the variety of papers that Legion stocks at www.legionpaper.com. My guest this week is Dana Varma, host of the wonderful podcast, Talk Paper Scissors. We talk about how print is most certainly not dead, how we learned about what was cool before the internet, and form versus function in typography. Hi, Nayana. How's it going?
Good. Thank you. Hi, Miranda.
I'm so happy to see you again. I thought we had one of the most fun talks I've had in a long time on your podcast, Talk Paper Scissors, a few months ago. And so I'm really excited to get the opportunity to reprise it and talk about more things, talk about more print with you.
I love that. Yeah, no, it was a really great conversation and I'm excited to be here. The tables are turned. I'm not used to being on this side. It's going to be fun. Let's do it.
Absolutely. As I said before, when you're the guest, you just get to sit back, relax, enjoy yourself. And so I'm looking forward to giving you that opportunity as you gave me. So before we get into it, though, would you please introduce yourself? Let people know who you are, where you are, what you do.
Yes, absolutely. So I'm Diana Varma, and I wear many hats. But the way I like to kind of describe myself is I'm a design educator, print and design educator by day, a podcaster by night, and a curious human by nature.
Oh, so, I like that.
So I am a tinkerer. I am someone who likes to kind of dabble in lots of different spaces. And I like to make things. I'm a maker. So in my day job, I have the really, really immense pleasure of getting to work with students and feeding off of their enthusiasm and their energy for the world of print and design. And then when I get to sit down with lovely people like yourself and other experts in the world of design and type and publishing and print through the podcast, it's just another opportunity to kind of soak it all in and remain curious. That's me. I'm curious always.
Love it. And so you say you work with students. What age range is this?
Mm-hmm. So I'm working...
I should say what grades, because obviously in college, people can come at any age. Yeah.
Yeah. So I am typically working with adults. So I'm working with undergraduate students primarily. So some students in first, second, third, fourth year of a post-secondary program. And I also, in the past couple of years, have had the really immense pleasure of working with master's students who are like a whole separate breed of awesome because they are coming at education from a very different place. They're more mature. They tend to be more mature. They tend to be kind of have more stake in the game, as it were. So they are on a whole different level when it comes to what we're able to do in the classroom together. So anyway, all is to say, I teach adults. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wonderful. Wonderful. And so where did you grow up, and what role did art, visual culture, design, what role did all those things play in that period of your life?
Yeah. So I should probably mention also, I forgot to mention this, but I am just north of Toronto in Canada. And so I teach at Toronto Metropolitan University, which is right in the core of our downtown. I grew up, so I'm now just northeast of that. I grew up slightly northwest of Toronto. And in that time, I was always like, I was a crafty kid. And my mom would always, so she loved Barbie growing up and would give me, I had so many Barbies. Just like, I remember I had the Barbie Dream Camper Van. I had the, I don't know, all of the special edition Barbies, what have you. And she just really wanted me to love Barbie like she did. And I just wanted crayons. I just wanted paper. I just wanted something to write with and doodle. And I'm not an illustrator by any stretch of the imagination, but I feel most at home with a writing utensil in my hand and paper in front of me. And so that was just always growing up. Like, that's what I remember is just crafty things all around me, paper all around me. Like, nothing has changed. I'm just slightly older, but it's all just like the same stuff all around me.
Yeah, books. Yeah. Now I'm wondering what graphic designer Barbie would look like.
Oh, I'll tell you.
Barbie.
I'll tell you what she'll look like. So I have here a replica of Gutenberg's press that I actually got at the Gutenberg Museum in Mainz, Germany. But who operates that press on my shelf is none other than Pantone Barbie. Oh, and she's breaking in front of me. But there we go. So Pantone Barbie is very glamorous. She is draped, cloaked in Pantone swatches, hot pink. Platinum
and
blonde
very
hair.
Graphic designer glasses on. Statement yeah. glasses.
So yeah. Those were an addition from my kids. This is, she did not come with these. They were, yeah, my kids thought she needed them. But all is to say, she runs the printing press. So this is who I imagine would be graphic designer / print Barbie.
I love it. So please send us a photo of graphic designer print Barbie so we can absolutely add it to the show notes for this episode.
I will. Absolutely.
Yeah. I really, this is a question maybe for another podcast, but I'd be super curious to hear what you thought about the Barbie movie, because I grew up with no Barbies. I was like a totally Barbie-less household. And so I didn't have any pre-existing emotional attachment to the canon when I saw the movie. But as a Barbie girl, what did you think?
So I feel like I had also little emotional attachment, even though I was surrounded by Barbies. And like, yeah, Barbies are a very big part of even our household today. We have all shapes and sizes of Barbies everywhere in this house. I don't know. I liked it. I mean, I thought it was, I've heard mixed reviews, but I thought it was timely and poignant and cute and all the things it needed to be. And I love the fact that the main three Kens, or two Kens plus Alan, were Canadian. That was another fun spin. And fun fact, Michael Cera, who played Alan, we went to high school together. So yeah, well, he didn't really, he was 2 years younger than me. But I knew of him, certainly, and he was good friends with, like, my friend's sister, like a friend of a friend of a friend.
Huh?
And then later in life, it was pretty funny. We connected very briefly again, and it's really random. We went to a casino. There was a casino thing where with like a group of us, and I was like Michael Cera's groupie for a night, and we played War together at the casino. Like, that's a whole other story as well. But anyway,
that's going to be for the celebrity goss and pop culture spinoff podcast.
Correct.
We can make together.
Correct.
That's amazing. That's amazing. It reminds me a little bit of, you know, my first podcast inspiration that had me begin, really partly the reason why Hello Print Friend exists, was This American Life. It was just a wonderful, almost like proto podcast, right? It was a radio show that was more like a podcast before anyone knew what a podcast was. And one of their really regular contributors, David Rakoff, who's a Canadian, has a story once where he says it's in the Canadian Constitution that when an actor comes up who's Canadian and you're Canadian, you have to say, they're Canadian, by the way.
Correct. Yes, this is absolutely true. There's an allegiance, like a secret underground club that we're all like, oh, and we're Canadian.
Yeah. You're a Canadian? Yeah.
Yep. I feel it.
Beautiful, beautiful. We'll put all of those in the notes for the Pop Culture Canadian podcast. And so you grew up as a maker, as you said, someone with a writing implement in your hand. At what point did you realize there's a whole world, there's a whole career, there's graphic design, there's printmaking, there's all of this, there's typography, that this is something that you can do and surround yourself with for the rest of your life if you wanted to?
Mm-hmm. I fell into it absolutely backwards, just like stumbled, tripped, whoa, oh, I'm here. Okay, let's hang out here for the next 20 years, because that's really what's happened. So the shortened version, the short story, is that end of high school, trying to figure out next steps in life, as we do. Mm-hmm. Throughout high school, I was always involved in many, many different kind of arts programs in high school. Like I was taking a media arts course where I was learning how to do actual kind of film photography and develop photos. I was taking drama courses. I was in the music program. I like all of these kind of artistic things, but never really graphic design, never really printmaking, like none of that. And I was actually headed in the direction of radio and television. Mm-hmm. And that's really kind of where I saw myself was doing something in the world of radio and television arts. And so I went, so that the university I now teach at, it used to be called Ryerson University. It's now Toronto Metropolitan University. But back when it was Ryerson, back in like 2003, when I was in grade 12, I went to just an open house and I was in a bad mood that day. And I was like, get me out of here. And my mom was like, I took a day off work. We are going to something. Like, figure it out, kid. We are not leaving here without seeing a program. And I was like, whatever, this is stupid. I'm a surly teenager. Ugh. Mm-hmm.
And my hormones.
Yeah. Correct. And so I just on a whim, my mom said, okay, I was speaking with your teacher, your media arts teacher, and she mentioned this other program at Ryerson. And it's, I don't know, it's called Graphic Communications Management. Let's go look at that, because it's kind of in the realm of media arts. You love media arts. Let's just go look at that. And I was like, fine. Ugh. So we went, and that is when I was introduced to a woman by the name of Mary Black. And for the printing industry, particularly here in Canada, Mary Black was a like driving force. She's an incredible woman. She has an incredible story whereby like she sold her home to buy a scanner to open up her company. Like she was a single mom, was like, nope, wow, this needs to happen, and just kind of went with it. And so all is to say, I got into a room, thankfully, with Mary Black, who convinced the group of us sitting there as 17-year-old students that the printing industry was not only the place we would want to be, but where we should be. And so within 10 minutes, she changed the total trajectory of where I was going and what I was doing. And so it was kind of this like beautiful happenstance moment that is like, whew, it's like emotional for me, because everything thereafter could have not been had it right. not been for that moment. So mm-hmm. it's so funny the way things work out. But one thing led to another. And I found my way into the printing industry. And then I found my way back into the program that I went to school for. And that's where I teach full time now. So it's really kind of a full circle moment. And I was recently, Mary Black has since passed away, and so our boardroom in our kind of, like, we are very, very grateful to have a building and very lucky to have a building on campus dedicated just to our students. We have a boardroom on the main floor, and it was the boardroom that I first met Mary Black in. And I was teaching there. I was I was teaching a group of students. It was the first day of class in the fall semester. And her name is now in the boardroom. And it was so cool to be in that moment in the room named after her. It was just, I don't know, it was cool. It was just such a cool moment. And it makes me so happy and sad and thankful and all the things for having found kind of, yeah, my way into that moment in time.
That's so beautiful. That's so beautiful. What an incredible homecoming for you and like your life and your trajectory. And yeah, thank you for sharing that story. It's lovely.
I didn't think I was going to cry, but here we are.
Here we are. It's funny. I totally get it. Sometimes just being asked to tell your own story in a linear way can be a powerful question because you don't sit around thinking about how you ended up where you are, right?
Totally.
And then when you realize, as you said, that it could have gone differently, the multiverse did a hard split when you and Mary Black met.
And maybe that alternate reality or 1,000 different alternate realities would have been just as good or better or whatever. But the fact that, I don't know, it's just like it all makes sense somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was your work in the printing industry before you made your way back into the fold and into the legacy of Mary Black?
Yeah. I don't want to say that. That's a lot of pressure. She was a big name around there. But so I had the great opportunity to work for a book printer. So I worked in kind of sales project management in the world of book printing. So I would have many, many clients who would come to me with book projects. So the HarperCollins of the world, the Penguin Random Houses of the world, the lots of other smaller publishers. And we would take their finished book projects and bring them to life. And so we actually have, and still to this day in Canada, there is a lot of book printing that happens. Not as much as there used to be, but certainly for kind of black only, so black text on white paper. A lot of that's still done here in North America.
Oh, cool.
Most books that are full color are done overseas for a variety of reasons, but we still print a lot of stuff here in this country. So that's what I did. I got to be around big presses and I got to take clients out for lunch and learn about what they need to have happen in terms of their print. And I would kind of be the liaison between the publisher and the manufacturing end of printing. And so it was one of my very favorite things actually was to do press checks, but specifically for the coding part of the process. So, I mean, we had lots and lots of different equipment, lots of different capabilities, one of which is to create like a very high gloss UV shiny coated cover or a spot coated cover. I'm trying to see if on my bookshelf if I have examples of this. Okay. So something like this, where it's shiny just in one area, right? So it's just kind of like it's hard to see still. There we go. There we go.
Oh, yeah.
A spot coating. But we could also do glitter. So I used to work in a lot with children's publishing. And so I would be asked to do glitter checks. So literally they would be at the kind of the coating machine and they would be sprinkling in this like vat of glitter. They're like, is that glittery enough? I was like, more glitter and more glitter. So yeah, I learned so much in that space and place for the 4 years that I worked in book printing. And yeah, I wouldn't trade that experience for the world.
Talking about all of this and thinking about design and visual communication, what was the name of the program? I don't want to get it wrong. Like visual design communications. What was the exact name?
Yeah, it's graphic communications management. So it's a bit of an anomaly. It's not a design school. It's not a business school. It's not a printing school. It's kind of all three. So the whole idea is that it's built on three pillars of creativity and design, of print and technology, and of entrepreneurship and business. And so it's kind of the OG program to be able to kind of take all three of those important components that are even more important today when you can start a business and the age of communication is democratized and the power of social media, all those things. But it really takes all a very holistic look at the world of print and design and being able to understand all the parts of the workflow, being able to oversee and manage all parts of the workflow to be able to really put some incredible stuff out into the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it must be a really interesting time. You know, just started your journey there. I think you said really 2003, I think you said you went and visited. So that's slightly over 20 years ago.
And
I went to my 20-year high school reunion last year and I was like, it's really weird that like all these people went to high school 20 years ago. And I think it's been like 7 for me, but but yeah, so but like for what's happened to print media in the last 20 years and the disruption, and then also at least from my experience with it, it's felt like it went from being omnipresent to being almost extinct to being more authoritative than it ever has been. So what I mean by that is it used to be the only way you got your news. Like the only way you found out what was cool is that you went down to the vintage clothing store and you tried to pick up the free issue of Vice before they got taken all away, right? Like that was how you learned what was cool in 2004. And then the internet happened, and obviously that was hugely, hugely disruptive. And internet happened, it's a very silly way of putting it exactly, but y'all know what I mean. And now it's like print feels like a luxury. Print feels like you can't trust the internet, but you can trust what's in print. Print feels like a self-care. Like if I'm reading a book or a printed magazine or anything that I'm actually holding, it feels like I'm doing something for myself. Mm-hmm. Whereas like if I'm on Wikipedia on my phone, staring at like the tiny backlit letters, that's doing research or that's doing something for work. But print now is comfort in a way that I don't think it was before, at least for me.
There's so much I could say here, and I'll try and keep it brief. But no, I completely agree. I mean, I think that print is dead was never a founded argument or statement. Mm-hmm. I think print is shifting is a much better way to think about it. And I think the way that you describe it as almost like a luxury, but more than that, being something that is trustworthy, something that is seen as self-care, something that is enjoyable to experience. I mean, looking at your phone feels very two-dimensional, and it is in a lot of ways for information or looking at a computer screen. But looking at print is very three-dimensional. There's smell associated with opening up a new magazine or a book and the smell of that ink. There is the cracking of the spine. There is the feel of the cover. There is a sensory experience that is not possible yet, anyway, in a digital environment. So the other thing I'll say about that is that there are definitely areas of print that are increasing. Mm-hmm. And there's demand for certain areas like packaging. Packaging is, whether we like it or not, whether it's the right thing or not, sustainability-wise, packaging is something that is a huge opportunity for our students leaving the program and hopefully to do good by the world and do kind of help guide the industry in a more sustainable direction. But packaging and printing on packaging is massive. Whereas, of course, newspapers and many other kind of mass media publications, they're dead and or dying, which makes total sense. Their purpose is to be informational, to be quick. You can't be quick when you are relative to the internet and relative to our social feeds and all the rest. You can't be quick when you are operating a three-story web offset press and trying to disseminate those physical products all over the country for the morning paper. I mean, news is old by that point. So it is a really interesting shift. And the other interesting piece of that is magazines, I think. So packaging is a really interesting piece. Magazines are massively interesting because of so many independent so many independent creations out there, independent publishers just kind of making things, but physically making the magazine. It's not necessarily designed just to live on a device, but there are technologies and there are digital printing technologies that look as good as offset, that look as good as traditional, that are making it able to, for someone's design, to sit beside a commercially published magazine and really be able to compete. I mean, there's also, in the magazine space, it's kind of, especially the independent magazines, it kind of bridges the gap between a book, which is meant to last for a long, long, long time. It's meant to be really high quality. It's priced as such. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you have kind of like the cheap magazines that you'd find at the grocery store. But these independent publications that are super niche and super kind of speaking to a very small audience, but still live in print, are priced higher than what we would find at the grocery store. They are priced lower typically than a book, somewhere in the middle, but they live in kind of this intermediary space where they're not meant to last and live forever. The information is meant to capture a snapshot in time. So it's this really interesting moment, especially for publishing, of like, oh, there's a whole bunch of different options now. And a lot of that is because of printing technology that is of high quality, but also digital. So we can produce something that looks just as good as the professional publication, but we can do it in a way that's scalable, that's maybe a single copy or 10 copies or 100 or 1,000 copies versus having to print 50 or 100,000 copies.
Yeah, it makes me think of the wonderful printmaking magazine Pressing Matters. I don't know if you know them, out of the UK.
Yes.
And how those, that's when I'm thinking of like, a kind of feels like a luxury experience. I mean, part of that is that just the editors and the curation, they always pick just beautiful photos. They've got great, I think, photographers that they work with. And it feels, but obviously we're not talking about an Us Weekly sized publication, right? For something that size, but it still feels so quality. And I've got, I think it's like my first issue that's held up for all these years and that thing. So yeah, that's niche market, and really interesting to think about how the technology has made that possible, as well as the demand of consumers as well. Yeah.
And that's the other neat thing, is that the internet and digital publications and printed publications don't live in two silos. They help one another and they support one another and they promote the growth of one another. So where digital is really good at being quick to be able to make changes, to be up to the minute, be able to link to different interesting areas, all of these things help get found, that the printed magazine is even kind of available and possible. And then print, you've got the same kind of platform or publication or message, but again, you can sit with the content a bit longer. It's longer form content. It's this beautiful sensory experience with touch and feel and smell, hopefully not taste. And it's just, there are two different experiences. So when I just don't believe fundamentally the argument that print is dead and the internet is killing print. I think they are long lost lovers who are supporting one another and doing the best they can to lift one another up. And really that's what I think where the magic is, that maybe is a missed opportunity in some cases and a gloriously kind of tried and true and experimental space for so many others as well.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Diana for president. So I've wanted to have you talk about this or hear your thoughts about this. And I don't have a super formulated question, so I'm just going to kind of throw some things at the wall here and see what sticks metaphorically. But it has to do with this really interesting history that printmaking has with the intersection with publication and what we maybe call print media when you're not in the fine arts, which of course is what we're talking about, magazines and books and that thing. And how it's this interesting world where there's so much cross-pollination, and yet sometimes people try to draw a really hard line that's like, well, now this is fine art. Well, now it's an artist book. Well, now it's all this thing. But of course, that's not how the world works. that all of these things move side by side and in and out. And what history and time changes that? Things that were considered utilitarian in print media become hallowed as art. I'm thinking botanical, lithographs or something like that, right? They maybe started as in a scientific manual, and now they're getting framed and sold at boutiques, that kind of thing. And so maybe just from your point of view and having lived and worked in this world, is it necessary to make a distinction in terms of fine art versus maybe functional art, or more commercial versus more artistic? And if so, where would you draw the line?
Can't we all just get along? I don't know. There's a couple of ideas that pop into my head. I mean, I was talking with my students about this just the other day, which is, and this is kind of indirectly maybe addressing the question, but what's the difference between art and design?
Mm-hmm. And that's so, the classic. Yeah.
The classic. So in my mind and in my experience, art is created for oneself as the audience. There may be other audience members who view it after the fact, but ultimately the art is created to express something, to be important and valuable to the creator, to the artist. And I think it also doesn't have to have a purpose or solve a problem. It's meant to demonstrate emotion. It's meant to share whatever gooey stuff is on the inside in a gooey way on the outside with ink or paint or whatever. But I think design is absolutely solving a problem through visual communication. And so a big part of that is that typically a client is involved, or there is someone who you are doing this work for. It's not to say that one is less than the other. I don't think. That's not my stance anyway. But there is a client involved typically. There are expectations to be met. There is a brief to be kind of followed or worked within. And so I think that's the big distinction, is kind of who the audience is and whether or not it solves a problem. And so that being said, yeah, I really like the example that you use of that kind of botanical print that was once very much a practical necessity, or was used for very practical reasons, created for practical reasons, but is now seen as kind of beautiful and something that can live like a piece of art would. So I don't know. I don't know that there has to be a distinction. I mean, I love the messy middle. I always say that with students, that like thinking in very black and white binary this or that terms is not helpful in most situations as a human being. And in most situations, thinking very linearly like that is not helpful to kind of move things forward and kind of grow and develop as an industry, as a society. And so something that comes to mind when I think of this, and it's a bit kind of to the left of or to the right of, but it's typography. So this is very top of mind for me right now, because I'm teaching a class in advanced typography, which is all about breaking the rules and all about like, what if, what if, what if. And next week, we're going to be chatting. I'm going to be chatting with the class about this idea of like, can design be genderless? We've often categorize type in these very distinct silos of, for example, serif versus sans serif, or kind of traditional categories of humanist versus transitional versus geometric sans serif, or whatever the case is. We try and lump them in these categories. And I think a lot of that lumping mirrors and mimics society at large. And so what we're seeing right now is in the design and type community is kind of a dismantling of the need to file something away on a shelf and say, this is what it is, and more of an opportunity to kind of do something weird in the messy middle, in the gray. So we're seeing a perfect example is like just a serif on the bottom of a character. So serifs are kind of very traditionally, they start off fairly thick and they narrow as they get to kind of the edge of the letter form. But of course, we have slab serif, which is something that was developed many, many years ago. But now we have everything in between. Like, is there a little like flick at the end? Is that a serif? Is there kind of like a ball terminal or something more geometric at the end? Is that a serif? Do we have to categorize it only as serif, sans serif? Can there be play in the middle? So all is to say, I'm not really answering your question, but I think that as a worldview, trying to narrow down and pin people, ideas, the world into categories is not helpful nine times out of 10. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think, I think that's true here as well.
Yeah, I think, yeah, you definitely are answering it in that way, that it's putting people, things, fonts, practices into boxes is unhelpful. And I think lazy, I think intellectually lazy a lot of the time. But I also stand by, I don't think anyone will ever be able to rescue the live, laugh, love font for me. That's going to be in a box forever. And I will always think badly of any context in which it's used.
And I think preferences are okay. That's a whole different beast, right? So subjectivity is fine, and we all have our opinions. But to categorically, to objectively say something is this or that, there are too many different ways of seeing the world, and too many interesting conversations in the middle as to why it shouldn't be in one box or another. I think that we're missing out on a lot of the good, deep stuff, rich stuff when we when we try to oversimplify.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And in terms of typography and its intersection with design and print media more broadly, I feel like that is one of the most obvious through lines to traditional printmaking and what happens now, because I think that there are, and I'm guessing you can speak to this more specifically than I, but I get the impression that there are a lot of kind of hangovers, holdovers in the typography world from when things were kept in drawers and pulled out and arranged and that thing. And I just think that that is such a charming aspect of what's left over, and a way that history shows up in the contemporary world, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Type is such a fascinating space. And I have dabbled in it for a number of years, and I've had the great pleasure of speaking with a number of experts in through the podcast who live and breathe typography, but I still feel like I'm just scratching the surface, even though I'm immersed in it all the time. But yeah, type is a cool place to be, because type is invisible when it's done really well, especially from a readability standpoint. It makes reading easier. It helps readers avoid having to read really intensely. But then it also plays this kind of, it has a duality. It plays this other role of being loud and obnoxious and interesting and controversial when it wants to pull you in. So going back to publication design, one of my very favorite things in specifically the magazine space is all this play in the world of design. And the fact that in most editorial features that are multi-page features, you're going to have some really, really expressive type that's like, whoa, pull you into that article, along with visuals and color and all the rest of it. And then you're probably going to have some pretty traditional, readable, accessible type that's chosen for the actual article itself to help you read over a long period of time. And so, I don't know, I just, there's so many interesting things in the space of type. And so speaking of like, I don't know, play and experimentation and not having to fit things in certain boxes. But I think where it shows up most readily for me and most interestingly for me is in the space of magazines.
Yeah, because that often there's so much information that needs to be organized and have some kind of a hierarchy and all of that. It's, yeah, I could definitely see that. Do you have any advice for printmakers who might be type curious, who might be thinking, maybe I do want to play with letterpress a little bit, or I do think that this piece needs text, or I know that this piece needs text, but what text? and I know it's going to be so specific to project and intention and all of that, but any golden rule guidelines, I guess.
No golden rules, but some hot tips. What I will say about playing with type is that it can be intimidating, but it can also be really freeing to know that there are so many different kind of typefaces out there to play with. I mean, letterpress printing. So I am just starting to dabble in the world of letterpress, and it's something that I've wanted to do for so long. And we have a little bit of that kind of equipment where I work as well, which I'm very fortunate to have. But I mean, we're not constrained unless you're actually physically using a letterpress. But even then, we're not necessarily constrained by 10 drawers of type. There is so much type out there, and even so much kind of AI that supports the pairing of type. And I don't know, there's just like, type shouldn't scare people because it's something that we instinctually know what it looks like, instinctually know how it's set. We've been playing with letters since we were 3 or 4 years old. And so I think because of that, there's just so much opportunity to do neat things. And when I say, specifically with letterpress, sometimes constraint breeds creativity. So if there are only those 10 drawers of type, just thinking about back to the basics, like the elements and principles of art and design. So if you only had, I don't know, again, a few different sizes and styles of type to work with. Think about the way in which you would play with proportion or play with kind of spacing or positioning, the way you might play with color, the way, I mean, I'm thinking of Amos Kennedy Jr., who we both had the pleasure of speaking with. And I mean, he layers color after color after color. So something that could be really mundane typographically all of a sudden becomes super interesting when you have this kind of layered multicolored effect. So there's, I think, just so much room for play with type, both in the digital side as well as the more traditional side. And even in the traditional side, I mean, you can get polymer plates made now where you're not constrained even by wood type or metal type. You can go out and have your digital design made into a polymer plate and print it on a letterpress. So all is to say that there is so much stuff that you can do with type is just to kind of get started, because quantity begets quality. You'll figure it out as you go. And so the more you're doing it, I think the better your eye becomes at going, oh yeah, I like that. Or, oh yeah, that's not really quite what I was going for. So it's, I think a lot of it's just in the doing.
Amazing. I love it. And that's in my very limited exposure to design, that is always really rang true for me too, is that like, I just have to throw whatever it is onto the page, onto the screen, and just say, do I hate this? You know?
And also sometimes who cares? Who cares if it's hideous at the end? I was even thinking about this just this morning. I mean, it's really the final end product of whatever we make, whatever day of the week, whether it's print or design or a sandwich, I don't care. Like the making, in the making, is where the growth happens. That journey of like the actual doing and the muscle memory and the motor skills and the thinking and the creative ideation and the place where my brain goes in seven directions, which ultimately leads to my next project. All of this kind of journey in the making is sometimes far more important than that final product being beautiful, perfect, whatever you think it needs to be. It can be garbage, but the whole middle bit could have been phenomenal. And that just is a jumping off point for the next try.
Yeah, that is so important to hear. I think particularly when we're in a world where there's so much pressure to document and show success and say, I did this thing and look, it came out perfectly. And that could be, if you're doing an art project, it could be if you're making a stew.
Have you been talking to my husband about my bad stews?
No, I was actually thinking about a friend who posted a photo of a beautiful stew, actually. And I haven't had lunch yet. So, and it's cold outside. but yeah, that it's just, and that that end result, that reveal, that before and after photo, that we're just in this world of that. And so I think the process can get lost, and the process that doesn't have a beautiful after photo can get lost as well, because we're created our own panopticon here where we're all observing each other constantly.
And yeah. I'm so torn with the idea of documenting the process. I absolutely get why someone wants to document the process, particularly if they want to share and post that. But I think it also takes you out of the moment. I think oftentimes if we're wanting to get that perfect shot, if we're trying to set up the camera a certain way, if we, right, there's like this certain underlying pressure and this underlying removal of ourselves from what we're doing. And if I know anything, I'm not good at it, but staying in the present moment and staying kind of in a flow state with whatever mm-hmm. you're doing is the best way to get time back. Time is our most precious resource as humans here on Earth. And by staying kind of focused in a flow state, doing something that's interesting and creative, time becomes this kind of molasses that stretches, or this all of a sudden you're not pouring out something that is just moving at a rapid pace. You're slowing time down. And I think that's what many of us crave in an age that's moving so quickly, is mm-hmm. the ability to slow down and the ability to really be present. And so for me, documenting the process, I think, takes us out of that a little bit. So I would love to see more, or less rather, less of that, and just hear, like, even I would love to see someone's a square on Instagram that is simply a single color. Maybe it's purple, maybe it's orange, maybe it's yellow. And the caption reads, "I made something today and I did not document it. And I spent 3 seconds uploading this. Have a great day. I hope you do the same." Like, to me, I'd be like, hell yes. I feel this viscerally. But I don't know. I mean, I get it. I get it that for many people, it's also a money-making venture. It's their living. It's mm-hmm. so there's kind of an expectation to feed the Instagram real monster and the stories monster. But I think it does take us out of ourselves mm-hmm. and strips us of our humanity and in that small way.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't be present if you're thinking about being observed. I don't think so. Yeah. And like creating the narrative for someone else that's not yourself.
Right.
Yeah. Totally. I want to make sure we have time to talk about your podcast, which you get to deep dive on all of these things that we're just kind of skirting, bouncing around, talking about, like the typography and design and print and all of that. So what made you want to start a podcast, and how did you go about doing it?
Yes. Okay. So it had been on my mind for a number of years. I used to work as our school's internship coordinator. So I was tasked with bright-eyed and bushy-tailed third-year students who were moving into their kind of first professional jobs, their paid internships. And the school said, here is 120 students, help them. And okay, yeah, cool, yeah. cool. So part of that work, and I loved that work. I think that work was so important. And I learned so much in the process of helping them before, during, and after their internships. It was really a great experience, and it was good. Part of that content and help that I wanted to give them, because I couldn't give each and every one personalized attention for obvious reasons, I thought, oh, a podcast would be a neat medium. Mm-hmm. And of course, there were other podcasts. I didn't kind of listen to a whole lot of podcasts. And this was probably 2014, 2015, something like that. But it was always on my mind, like, ooh, I should do this and create content, these kind of mini episodes before, during, after internship. I would call it the Avid Intern, and this would be a really good project to partake in. Didn't happen. Ran out of time. Had a baby. Mm-hmm. Got married. All the things. Internship coordinator job. Someone else is doing it. So when I was on parental leave with my second daughter, my creative juices were kind of wanting to do something. I had a bit of free time, even though I had an infant. I have a friend who is a lawyer and she has a baby. And the way she describes early motherhood is it's boring and it's stressful. I was like, you nailed it. You totally nailed it. Like, yes, there are moments of delight in there. There are moments of joy. Mm-hmm. But by and large, 23 hours of the day are boring and stressful. So in that boring and stressful time, I needed a creative outlet. And I just thought, oh, now would be the perfect time to create some podcasts. Mm. And I don't need it to be about internship stuff. It can be about anything. So maybe I'll start this little passion project. And so Talk Paper Scissors was born November 24th, 2019. I think that's the day. It's a very official birthday. And kind of the rest is history. And in that very first episode, I remember placing the caveat at the end of the episode where I said, I am not putting any pressure on myself to do this any more than this one episode even. And who knows where it's going from here. And it's probably going to be garbage, but let's just do it anyway. And so it kind of evolved and I gave myself the space and the grace to say, this, you will get better each time you do this. And only do it when you want to. Like, there is no pressure. There's no commitment. There is no anything. This is a sacred creative space. And so really, my plan originally wasn't even to have it as kind of an interview show. It was more, I don't know what it was going to be, truthfully. But I didn't even anticipate being able to speak to world-renowned experts in type and design. And like, that has been a very cool evolution. And it's kind of interweaved with my teaching as well, which is a neat thing. During the pandemic, when I went back to work full time, I tried to really get ahead of Zoom fatigue. I mean, I knew that students, this was September 2020, so the pandemic was well underway, 5 months in, and they're like, all right, everybody, back to school, but completely online, and no one knows what they're doing, and go. And so
everyone is worried that everyone's going to die.
Correct.
Also, but go keep living your life.
Yes. Yeah. All the things. So what I ended up doing, which I'm super proud of, and it's not it, like it, it was not polished or perfect by any stretch, which was never my goal. But what I decided to do to get ahead of Zoom fatigue, I did not ask my typography students to meet me every week online. Mm. So it was meant to be kind of a lecture only course that I was teaching, or the lecture portion of the course. And instead of having a weekly lecture, that summer leading up, I wrote scripts and stories and histories and all of the things that I wanted to teach them in person, but I wanted to do it using a podcast, using a storytelling medium, and they could listen at their convenience during the week. Mm-hmm. So there was an episode or two, probably 20 to 40 minutes long, we'll call it. And they could be doing laundry or taking the dog for a walk or driving to get groceries or whatever they were doing in their life and be able to listen to the content that week, told in a relatively entertaining way that was something different. So that is how the course actually continued to run even post-pandemic. And it's now back in class and it's kind of back to business as usual. I kind of miss that format of giving students the chance to just walk and listen. But yeah, anyway, all I'm trying to say here is it really is still that sacred creative space for me. And even though it does and has intersected with my day job, I really have still that first episode holds true where I place zero pressure on myself to release weekly. I place zero pressure on myself for it to be quote unquote good. I'm coming at it from a well-intentioned place. I'm coming at it from a passionate place. I'm coming at it with genuine curiosity. And I think for me, that's enough to be able to hold someone's attention. And if it holds two people's attention, great. If it holds 200 or 2,000 people's attention, great. Like, if no one shows up to listen, I would still make the episodes.
Yeah, I think I've said something really similar about this podcast where I really just want to have conversations that I want to have and make good tape.
Yep.
That's it. And I've had people point out, there's no tape anymore, Miranda. I'm like, it's just spiritually, we're making good tape, you know? And just things that I want to exist in the world. Yeah. And I think that's the only way to keep it sustainable is for it to be something that fills your cup rather than drains it. Yes. When there's so much else in this world.
Yeah. And I often also say this to my students, like, you need to figure out what success looks like for you, because the world will tell you what success looks like. It will tell you that success looks like followers and book deals and a lead role on a TV show and many, many, many other very easy to measure, quantifiable, visible things.
Numbers in your bank account.
Yep. Like. But oftentimes, more often than not, success is, the metrics of success are invisible. They're hard to quantify. They are quieter. They are less about ego. They are all the things that kind of we don't, growing up, see modeled to us as what success can look like. And for me, like you're making good tape, success on this podcast is me showing up and feeling in my gut that I've created something that is that I would want to do this even if no one's listening. I think that's what it comes down to, is very similar to what you said. Like, I just want to create stuff that I really feel strongly about. I hope others do too, but it's just, I want it to exist in the world.
Yeah. What are your favorite kind of conversations to have on Talk Paper Scissors?
I mean, not that I'm a contrarian, not that I want to cause controversy, but I really love proving people wrong, in the sense that, I mean, you must find this as well, but like, oh, okay, so you're talking about design and print and type and all the things. So visual. Why don't you become a YouTuber? Why don't you do something that's much more, that we can see what's happening? Like, why would you choose an audio format for something that is inherently visual? And I say, watch me. And like, let's have a conversation about something really technical in type, or let's have a conversation about something that, yeah, doesn't necessarily lend itself to a verbal only conversation. But I think that if we can find a way to do that, those are my favorite conversations, is to have people go, oh, I get it. I'm listening. I'm only listening, but I understand. And there's visuals in the show notes and all the rest. But I mean, like, just being able to kind of rewrite the story of what a podcast can be.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, is there anything on the horizon that you want to talk about? Anything for the future of either Diana or Talk Paper Scissors?
That's a good question. There's always things that pop up. But what I will say that I'm really excited about right now, that is something I had the great pleasure and honor of doing back in November, was play with Lego letterpress in a workshop capacity with a room full of designers. So Lego letterpress is something that is relatively new to me, being able to use Lego dots, Lego base plates, ink, paper, kind of a modified makeshift traveling printing press, and just be able to go and infuse play with print. And that's something that I have the great pleasure of being able to head to Vancouver. So we're taking it to the West Coast. That's happening in May at Design Thinkers Vancouver, which is a big design conference out west. And so, yeah, we're just going to get in a room and, again, infuse print with play and see what comes of that. So I have high hopes for far more kind of fun with Lego letterpress.
And where could people find you and follow you and maybe see some of the outcomes of Lego letterpress in Vancouver?
Yeah. So probably the easiest spot to find me is on Instagram. So at Talk Paper Scissors, or you can check out my website, talkpaperscissors.info.
Beautiful.
Oh, hold on. I just thought of one other fun thing. Can I do a quick?
Please.
Okay. So this is a project that I started last year. I sat down for many, many, many months, and I literally picked up again yesterday. And so this is something called The Creative Confidant, and it is a book project, a self-published, likely, book project that I am writing in a community space. So through Substack, which is a really brilliant platform that is relatively new. But basically, I am writing this book all about creative confidence that is written story by story by story in an open public space, released story by story by story, completely free and just kind of open to experimentation in the process. So you can find me at dianavarma.substack.com as well if you want to follow along.
Very cool. We can put that in the show notes too, because that sounds like a really interesting project. So
yeah, we'll see where it goes. No pressure.
Yeah, no pressure. I love your no pressure creative output energy.
Listen, when the pressure is squeezed, it just doesn't work for me. It may work for others. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't work for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for this conversation, for coming on and chatting with me. It was delightful. I hope that people absolutely check out your podcast. We had a great conversation on it, but you've also had guests that I've loved. You mentioned, like, we both got the honor and privilege of talking to Amos, of course. So yeah, I will really, really encourage people to go listen. You have great conversations, and thank you again for letting me borrow an hour of your Saturday and having the chat.
Thank you so much, Miranda. It's been a pleasure, and it's been wonderful being here.
And that's our show for this week. Join me again in 2 weeks' time when my guests will be John and Diana from Lito Editions. Lito Editions is based in Bregenz, Austria, and they use a new print technology to create prints with extreme precision and relief effects. We talk about the founding of Lito and what it's like to collaborate with some of the world's biggest artists with a new print technology. You won't want to miss it. If you liked today's episode, we have a Patreon where you can help support our podcast and get bonus content, like Shop Talk Shorts with past guests. But the very, very best thing you can do to support us is listen, rate, follow, and share with your fellow print friends around the world. This episode, like all episodes, was written and produced by me, Miranda Metcalf, with editing by Timothy Pawshak and music by Joshua Weber. I'll see you in 2 weeks.